offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. As always, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and here to continue with this series on the Bhagavad Gita, where we take the shlokas one by one, try to understand them in depth. We are in the third chapter. The third chapter is referred to as the chapter on Karma Yoga, and that's what we've been dealing for the past couple of months. The last week, we did not go through any specific shloka as such, because I give a very general summary on the Karma Yoga itself. The discourse is still in progress, but I thought it's good to take a pause and summarize the points which Krishna was referring to as Karma Yoga, because this is probably the most important practical aspect of the Bhagavad Gita. If we all do not want to stop with just reading and listening about and going through the shlokas of the Bhagavad Gita and want to start acting on it, then the actionable points are there in this particular the verses that we completed till about the week before the last one. And that's why the last week I thought it would be good for all of us to take a break and summarize the points that we had gone through. At the end of last week's summary, I had given about 7 or 8 points of whatever Krishna has been saying, which could be put down as the points that define Karma Yoga. So I thought usually we begin with a summary of the previous work. I thought maybe it would be a good thing to reiterate those 8 points quickly and then move on to some of the very, very interesting shlokas that we have for today. So let us start by that, and we'll take on the new shlokas after that. So the first point about Karma Yoga is that you don't have to change the karma that you are doing. Whatever profession that you're doing, whatever role that you've taken up, be it that of a mother, a housewife, or that of a policeman or a pilot or whatever you'd like to call it, you don't have to give up that and take another role if you wish to take up Karma Yoga. That was the first point. The second one is respect karma, for it is a means to the highest goal. When you say that this is a tool that is going to give you the ultimate destination, take you to the ultimate destination, then you have to look at it with a little bit of reverence. In fact, I was going through this discourse which Swami gave way back in 1953, where he makes this point, and I quote, Swami says, "Karma can save as well as kill. It is like the cat that bites. It bites the kitten in order to carry it in its mouth to a place of safety. It bites the rat in order to kill and eat it. Become the kitten and karma will rescue you like a loving mother. Become a rat and you are lost." Right? So Swami says the same actions, the same professions that you do, the way you approach it, it can either become a regular karma that binds, or it can be a Karma Yoga that releases. So in both ways, you have to look at karma with reverence. The third point being, consider all actions as offerings to God. And this one attitude of doing whatever you do as an offering to God leads to the next few points, which again are very, very critical. The next point being, when you say that I'm doing it as an offering to God, you have to do it as perfectly as you can, as sincerely as you can, as diligently as you can. Apart from doing it as perfectly in the physical sense, you'll have to do it with a little more love, a little more patience, and a little more kindness than you would have done it otherwise. The moment you say this, I'm doing it as an offering to Swami, it has to bring in those elements which are very dear to Swami, that are we being accommodative? Are we able to act in a united manner? Are we able to be patient and forbearing with others' views and others' problems or whatever it is? That the ability to bring in that little more love and patience is more important. And the next point being, we will have to keep trying to improve this. There is nothing like perfection in this till the ultimate stage. So as much as possible, keep improving our physical activity as well as the bhavam or the feeling aspect that goes into doing that particular activity. The next point is, if the mind ever seeks a reward, the mind seeks recognition or appreciation from people around, don't be too upset with yourself. I think that is the nature of the mind. We will have to give it to the mind. But let us not give in to that. Let us acknowledge that that's the nature of the mind. But then stop and remind ourselves that when we did it as an offering to Swami. And when we do it as an offering to Swami, we should not be expecting recognition, appreciation from the people around. And this leads us to the point that it is very, very important to give time to ourselves for such self-reflection, which leads to recalibration. Because the mind being used for what it is being used, it will be dragged outward. It will be seeking for benefits outside. And that is why it is very important to take that time out, be it in the form of going and sitting in a temple or sitting in your altar, silent sitting, meditation, attending bhajans or going on short pilgrimages. All of this is meant for this recalibration of what you're doing it for, and is the mind seeking anything else when the activity is being done or after it has been completed. The next point is, when a work is well done, applause, recognition will come eventually. Even if you say, I don't want it, it will come. So when it comes, accept it as Swami's prasadam. And just like how applause and accolades will come, failures also will come. I think that is also part of it. So Swami says, accept that also as Swami's prasadam. And accept applause and adverse effects as prasadam. And finally, find a different way of measuring your progress, not the worldly way we are used to. Am I becoming richer? Am I becoming more influential? Instead of seeing those as the barometers by which we judge our progress, can we judge our progress through measures such as contentment? How much joy do we derive from doing the work itself? Are we able to do the work with enthusiasm? Are we able to go about with calmness and peacefulness? Right? Because the moment when we don't crave for credit, it actually unleashes our enthusiasm. We might sometimes think that if I'm not interested in the results of my actions, I will become dull. But when we forget about who gets the credit for what we do and we don't bother about whether people recognize or don't recognize us, it unleashes the enthusiasm with which we will act. So it will show in us enthusiasm, and it will show in the form of calm and peacefulness that will become our very nature. So these are the different points that Krishna has been telling over the past few shlokas in the third chapter and towards the end of the second chapter. So this was the summary that we went through last week. So we'll go to the shlokas that we have this week. I'm going to play for you shloka number 32, as always, beautifully and clearly rendered by Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus, who has rendered all the shlokas so far on the show, and by Swami's grace is going to do it for the rest of the series too. The shloka number 32 is actually a joint to shloka number 31. 31 and 32 are in a way a paired shloka. We will see that when we go through the shloka and I give you the meaning and we discuss about it. So feel, as always, listen to the shloka first. I'll give you a brief meaning of that shloka and then we'll discuss more deeply about it.
Yetve tadabhyasuyanto nanu tishthanti me matam sarvajnana bimudhanstan viddhi nashtana chetasaha.
But those who, finding fault, do not follow this doctrine of mine, be sure that these men to be highly deluded in all knowledge and to be lost and mindless. In the previous verse, that is verse number 31, Krishna spoke about ye me matamidam nityam anutishtanti manavaha, which means those that follow incessantly this instruction of mine. Right? He was referring to those people in verse number 31. In this particular verse, Krishna is saying, tu, whereas, ye yetat na anutishtanti me matam, those who do not follow the teaching of mine. So he is contrasting the two groups, the followers and those who do not follow. But Krishna uses another word in the first line, which is very important. The first line actually goes, he says, ye yetat abhyasuyanto na anutishtanti me matam, those who do not follow out of abhyasuyantaha. The word means a feeling of indignant, or feeling indignant or being critical about what is being told. In the previous verse, Krishna had said anasuyanto. The word that he had used in the second line was anasuyanto. And here he says abhyasuyantaha. Both these words are like the opposite, the antonyms of each other. But the root word in these both, anasuyanto and abhyasuyanto, is the word asuya and the word anasuya. The word asuya is mostly used for jealousy, right? So what does Krishna mean when he says following with anasuya or without jealousy and not following out of asuya or jealousy? When I'm trying to follow the path of Karma Yoga, for that matter, when I'm trying to lead a simple moral life, what is it that creates confusion in the mind? When I see a person doing something wrong and getting away with it. When I see a person who is living a life contrary to my idea of what is right, and he's being rewarded by it, or he's being given a better position in life than me. Won't that disturb me? I think that is what disturbs most of us, isn't it? It'll lead to a doubt in the mind whether the path that I'm following, is it valid or not? So in this case, the path that we're talking about is Karma Yoga, which Krishna is teaching. So I think Krishna is referring to that attitude which comes when we look around and we see those people who should not be, in our opinion, getting where they're getting or getting away with what they are doing, but they're getting away, right? That asuya is what causes doubt in our mind. So those who are weak in mind, those whose faith gets disturbed by such inputs from outside, those that don't have the patience to follow and give these instructions of Krishna a chance, a fair chance, Krishna is referring to such people. So in the previous shloka, Krishna mentions the word Shraddha, right? Apart from saying that anasuyanto, he also uses the word Shraddha. The word Shraddha, we all know it means faith. But there can never be faith without patience. Because faith means you trust in something that it is not so obvious to your perception already, right? So when you follow some instruction of the guru or follow some instruction of Swami out of faith, we should have the patience to see the results that accrue of it later, right? And that is why Shirdi Baba would always say, give me Shraddha and Saburi. Because faith and patience, Saburi means patience, are like two sides of the coin. Without patience, you will never develop that faith, right? And whatever Krishna has been telling so far, you know, whether God is on earth as an avatar or he's not there as an avatar, if you follow this, you might be following it in India, you might be following it in Russia or Greece or whichever part of the world, it doesn't matter. It still works. But for us to know that, for us to see that it works, we must have the patience to see this whole system working out, right? We might not necessarily be rewarded in the material sense, but at least we'll feel that unshakable self-satisfaction, and that'll be the reward, right? And when we notice that, we will be able to see that the system works, right? And when we start looking outside and start getting disturbed by those people who are apparently getting away with doing the wrong thing, then we do not have that patience to see the system works, and Krishna is referring to such people. So in other words, those that find fault with this teaching of Krishna without giving it a fair chance, what happens to them? Krishna says, Tan Vidhi, know them to be Sarvajnana Vimudhan, being deluded in all fields of knowledge. What does this actually mean? In my opinion, I think it means that this knowledge which Krishna has been explaining, how one must act, how one must carry on duty like someone who is doing a yajna, how one must not be attached to the outcomes, etc., etc., whatever he's been saying, this is the basis of how creation works. Imagine if you get this basic understanding wrong. Imagine you've got into schooling and you've got the basic idea of arithmetic all wrong, your basic addition and subtraction and all that, you've got it wrong. All the other advanced subjects in mathematics, like starting from fractions to quadratic equations to algebra to geometry to calculus to real analysis, there is a chance that you'll get all of this wrong because you've got the basics wrong, right? So this Karma Yoga is like that. It is like the fundamental basic understanding. If you fail to understand and accept this, you are going to get everything about life wrong. What is duty? What is morality? What is right and wrong? What is to be, what is it to be spiritual? What is the goal? What is sannyasa? What is tyaga? All of these concepts, you will get it wrong. So understanding with regards to all this will get muddled up if you don't understand this basic explanation that Krishna is giving. Right? This is what Krishna is saying in the shloka. That is why Krishna says, know such a person to be sarvajnana vimudhan, as being deluded in all forms of understanding or all forms of knowledge. And finally, Krishna says, nashtan achetasaha, will eventually be ruined, and achetasaha will lose his mind or lose his discrimination altogether. In fact, in Gita, talking about this verse number 31 and 32, where Krishna says that those who follow with faith, this will happen. Those who do not follow with faith, this will happen. Such paired shlokas, I think we'll come across more often in the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, this is a pattern that you'll find in many of the scriptures too. I think we have already come across a couple of verses like this, where Krishna says, if you do your duty, this will happen. If you don't do your duty, this will happen. This is very important means by which this knowledge is being imparted to the disciple, where it is saying this is the right thing to do, but it doesn't stop with that. It completely, you know, removes the contrary path also. It is not only about choosing this path, but it is also about debunking the other path completely, so that you stick to this, right? That's one of the approaches the Bhagavad Gita takes, and all other scriptures, as I said. Before we move on, there is one more point that I thought I should make when we are talking about Krishna saying sarvajnana vimudhan, and those that, you know, those who get completely deluded when they don't follow what Krishna is saying. If you take a look at what Krishna has been explaining so far, it is the most straightforward approach to spirituality. There is nothing jing-bang here, there is nothing flowery here, there is nothing exotic here. It's simple. It's simply what you have to do in your everyday life to make your life spiritual and reach the goal, right? And it is accessible to everyone. You could be a farmer, you could be a laborer, you could be the king, you could be a minister, you could be, you know, whatever it is. You could be the most fancy post, or you could be the most ordinary person. This path is accessible to everyone, right? That's why when I first point I said about Karma Yoga, when I was summarizing, is you do not have to change what you are doing, which means this path is applicable and accessible to everybody on the world. It is not based on gender, it is not based on birth, it is not based on profession or one's financial status or whatever. But we often have very, very fanciful ideas of what is a spiritual path, right? We talk of all kinds of things like tantric practices, or some very, very exotic types of meditation. We talk about getting visions. More or less, we get so carried away by all of these fancy things in the name of spirituality. But if you look at it, spirituality is so simple and straightforward. And it's probably because it's so simple, it doesn't interest us, you know, as much as it should. As Krishna has been saying, nothing. It's just gratitude leading to non-doership, carrying out one's duty sincerely, leading to the purification of the chitta, not letting the desire for the outcome decide our actions, that leading to detachment, and all of this leading to samatvam or equanimity. Krishna says that is spiritual life. Samatvam yoga mucchate. To have that equanimity is what is referred to as yoga, right? So Krishna is saying that this is the ultimate. But those for whom this vidya or learning that Krishna is teaching is too simple to be true. A lot of us, you know, debunk this because it's too simple. I want something more exotic. Those who do not take this to be the true ultimate path, Krishna says, ye yetat abhyasuyanto na anutishtanti me matam. Those who do not take up this because they get carried away by what they see around, you know. Abhyasuyanto means looking at people around and getting carried away by it. So this is one more way of looking at it, that here is the spiritual path, straightforward and simple. But looking around, you see somebody who is doing some other form of sadhana, you see somebody gaining some siddhi powers or whatever. These are all distractions in the path. And we end up running after all these fanciful techniques, and then, you know, we want to take up all these kind of sadhanas and all of that. It'll only lead to sarvajnana vimudhaha, we will only get more and more delusional in this process, right? And that is why even if you see Swami's message, it is always so straightforward and simple. Going through this chapter on Karma Yoga itself, we can say one thing, that it's going to take us a long time before we are able to live our life in the manner Krishna has described. I'm not saying that all these techniques, Tantra, Kundalini, seeing visions, visualizations, all these are wrong or all these do not take you anywhere. I do not have the qualification to say that. I don't know any of these paths. I have not read enough in all of them. And always there is much, much more to life than we ever acknowledge, right? So I am not at all qualified to speak about all these paths. But I think going through what Krishna has been telling so far, the point is, what is the ultimate goal of that we are all aspiring for? You know, you might be a great yogi doing Hatha Yoga and Kundalini Yoga and all of that, or you could be a simple householder or a simple person like you and me going through the Bhagavad Gita. What is that final goal that we are looking for? Isn't it the final union with God or our true self, as you want to define it? You can call it the state of yoga, call it moksha, call it param gati, call it samadhi, call it param shreya, or simply param, the ultimate state. These are all different words that Krishna has used so far in the Bhagavad Gita. That's why I'm recalling all of them, right? So whatever you call that final state, Krishna is saying that you can reach that through this process of Karma Yoga, right? That's what he's been telling in this third chapter. You can reach that ultimate state through this Karma Yoga, right? So all these other methods may be valid, but they're all only paths to the same goal. And here Krishna is saying that this is the fundamental path. This is the foolproof path coming from the Lord himself. The Lord himself is saying that this, if you follow, you can reach me. And that's why Swami would often say, he would quote this Sanskrit verse, Tyage naike amritattvam anashu. The ultimate amritattvam or immortality can be reached only through tyaga. And what has Krishna been doing so far? He's defining what that sacrifice of tyaga is. Right? And if we have that faith and patience, if we do not get carried away by all the fancy things that happen around us, which is all that we require, Shraddha and Saburi, then I think we will say, this is enough for me. Swami, this path that you've shown is enough for me, because it's going to take a lifetime, right? We will follow it diligently. You know, I can't speak for everybody else. Maybe there are some people in the audience who have said that, you know, I've started following it, but certainly I'm not following it, and it's going to take a long time before we can completely align ourselves to whatever Krishna is saying. And if we have that Shraddha and Saburi, we will stick to this. We will not get distracted. We will not get disillusioned by whatever other people are doing around, and we will stick to the simple path. Yes, maybe it is a little tasteless for some of us who want to have visions, who want to have some powers, who want to levitate when we meditate. But Krishna is saying, and Swami has also reconfirmed it, that this will lead to the ultimate state. Do whatever you do, do it as an offering to God, do it with sacrifice, and find happiness in doing it as an offering, right? But if you don't want to do that, if you do not see value in this, we will only be deluding ourselves further and further. It will only lead to nashtan achetasaha. We'll be ruined and we'll lose the mind. And whenever we use these words like nashtan, you'll be ruined, there is no concept of perdition in Vedanta. There is no concept of eternal hell. There is no concept of eternally being doomed. It's just that you're going to be little more deluded. You're going to be little more muddled. The path is going to become a bit more long winding, right? That's what we are referring to. So when we have the Guru before us, when we have the Lord showing us the path, it makes no sense to say, I will get distracted, I will do all of this, and then I'll come back to your path. It makes sense to stick to it. And that is why Krishna is saying that with Shraddha, with that patience, without getting deluded, follow this and you will reach the goal. So that's verse number 32. As I said, 31, 32 is two shlokas that come as a couple. So we'll go to shloka number 33. It's a very, very interesting shloka. You will see how it's a little different from whatever we've been speaking so far, but it speaks of a very, very important topic in this chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So we'll listen to chapter Shloka number 33 of chapter 3. I'll give you a simple meaning for that and then we'll discuss in detail.
Sadrusham cheshtate swasya prakruter jnanavanapi prakrutim yanti bhutani nigrahah kim karishyati.
Even a wise man acts in accordance with his own nature. All beings will follow nature. What can restraint do? So that's verse number 33. We saw that Krishna has explained, as I said, the simple and the most accessible path to the ultimate goal. He has also said that this is it. If you do not follow it, you only walk down the path to ruin. In Shankara's commentary to that particular verse that we covered, that was verse number 32. The one I played is 33. The one I explained was 32. So in his commentary to verse number 32, as the Bhashyakara, he adds or he asks a question. Then what stops one from following this? When it is so clear what one has to do, why are people not able to follow this? Forget those people who have no clue about the spiritual goal. Those that say that I am this body, as long as I live, I have to seek pleasure and do whatever it takes to pamper myself. Let's forget about those people. And as we once discussed, the modern day followers of the Charvarka philosophy, let's not bother about them. Forget such people who are completely lost. They will come to their senses eventually. Take people like us, for example, just what I was telling you before I played that shloka. You know, we know that life is more than just living. Life is more than just making merry and hoarding wealth. We know that there is a purpose to this life and we must try and achieve that thanks to Swami, thanks to the many, many great gurus whose satsang has driven this idea into our mind. And now we are studying the Bhagavad Gita. If we didn't have faith in it, we would not have started the study at all, right? I wouldn't be doing this program week after week if I do not trust that this text has a solution to the greatest problem of life. And I don't think some of you listeners who come week after week and listen to this program would be doing this if you do not have faith and trust in this particular text. So we know that life is more than just living. We know that there is a solution in the Bhagavad Gita. But can I say that now that I've read chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita, which is about Karma Yoga, bang, tomorrow I wake up and I become a Karma Yogi? Can I say that? Well, I don't know if any of you are nodding your head and saying that, yes, we have already done it and today we are all Karma Yogis. I can speak for myself. No, it's going to take a long, long time before I can claim that I am following what Krishna has told in chapter 3 of Karma Yoga. Right? I know that this is right. I know that I have to do this. But it's not going to be easy to do it. It is not easy right now. But in a way, in this particular verse, before we come to this verse, Shankara adds this question to give a context to what Krishna is telling in verse number 33 that we just heard, which otherwise might look a bit disconnected to what we've been speaking so far. Till now, Krishna has been speaking about as we were saying, those who follow it, and about Karma Yoga itself. But here suddenly he's talking about why people are not able to follow. And that is why Shankara, to give it a context, adds these questions. But even otherwise, if you look at it, you know, here Krishna is talking about prakriti and nature of a person. It is a continuation of Krishna speaking about the gunas and the gunas dictating one's actions that we came across a couple of verses back. Of course, in our case, it's a couple of fortnights back because that's how slowly we're going in the Bhagavad Gita. But Krishna has mentioned it. So in a way, it's a continuation. But this is where I feel Krishna slightly confuses Arjuna. And if we are following the Bhagavad Gita keenly, even we should get a little confused at this point. So a clue to all of you who are listening, you're supposed to get confused in this particular verse and you'll see why I'm saying this. In this shloka, Krishna says, Jnanavan api, even the wise, sadrisham cheshtate, act according to swasyaha prakritehe, their own nature. Krishna is saying, even the knowledgeable, jnanavan, or the learned act according to their inner nature. Till now he was talking about the jnani as being supreme and all of that. We can't be sure whether Krishna is referring to the jnani here. He says jnanavan, which could probably be what I just said about you and me, that we know that life is more than just this, and we know that this is the path. At least that information we have, we at least have that data with us to work with. So Krishna says, jnanavan api, even the wise sadrisham cheshtate swasyaha prakritehi, act under the force of their own prakriti or their nature. The other Sanskrit word which Swami would often use is swabhava, which is your nature, which is your internal makeup. So when the wise themselves only follow the nature, what can we say about the others? What can we, if at all Krishna is referring to the jnani in this particular verse, then it spells doom for all of us. Even a jnani works according to his prakriti, then what about you and me? Krishna goes on to say, prakritim yanti bhutani, all beings, bhutani means all beings, prakritim yanti, follow their nature, not only the jnanavan, prakritim yanti bhutani, all beings follow their prakriti. Nigraha kim karishyati. Nigraha means control or coercion. I think we've heard Swami use this word many, many times when he says indriya nigraha means sense control. So nigraha kim karishyati. What can self-control achieve? So here is Krishna saying, when all beings, even those that have jnana, only follow their nature, simply controlling or forcing oneself, what can it achieve? Now, this is what I refer to as the most confusing part. Till now, Krishna was giving instructions. He was telling Arjuna what to do, what not to do, and how to do. But in this shloka, he says, each one acts according to their nature. Even a jnanavan acts according to one's prakriti, and what can nigraha do? We would have heard Swami, we've been hearing Krishna saying that you should have self-control, but here is he saying, what can self-control do? In other words, Krishna is literally negating the presence of free will. Can I take up an action today, or can I change the way I do actions today? Can I change the way I respond to what people do around me? Can I change the way I respond to the way life treats me? Right? For all this, I need free will. But here Krishna is saying that everybody acts according to their nature. Control cannot do anything, which means he is literally removing free will from the picture. He's saying everyone is dictated from within. They do not have a choice or the ability to take control of their lives. Then the question comes, then why the Gita? Why any advice? Why Karma Yoga? Why all the scriptures would tell us what to do and what not to do? If my nature is that of a yogi, then I'll automatically be a Karma Yogi, isn't it? And if my nature is that of a bhogi or a worldly person, then I will do regular karma. So a bhogi can never become a yogi, and a yogi will remain a yogi. Right? That's what it means. We will all become like animals and plants which cannot do anything but simply follow their pre-programmed nature. So what Krishna is saying here literally negates the advice he has been giving so far. Right? And all the advice that we receive from any scripture or any Shruti or Smriti, whatever it may be. So why is Krishna saying this? And this is why I said, if we have been following the Bhagavad Gita clearly at this point, we should get confused and we should get alarmed. I said, Krishna, what are you saying? Because you're kind of pulling the rug from under my feet, right? But the fact is, both of these are true. We all act according to our inbuilt nature. That is true. And we all have the choice to change it too. That is also true. What Krishna is saying is, you cannot stand up one day, take a whip, and tell your mind, look, give up all your desires and tomorrow onwards become a yogi. That is never done. So what must we do? We say that prakriti or the nature of a person dictates his or her actions, isn't it? But how is that nature formed in the first place? yes, his sthitapragna also may be acting according to his nature, but his nature has become that of the sthitapragna, and that is governing his actions, right? I am a bhogi. My bhogi nature is making me do bhogi karma. A sthitapragna is having a sthitapragna prakriti or a sthitapragna nature, and his actions become that of a sthitapragna. So how did that nature come to be? We all were, you know, as they say, chips from the same block. How did somebody become a sthitapragna and how did I become a bhogi? So what was it that led to this nature becoming what it is? Maybe if we figure that out, we can similarly form the nature of a yogi through a certain form of effort, isn't it? So there must be a small window of opportunity in all this that is available to us, and that is what Krishna and all the scriptures have been pointing to us, asking us to utilize that window of opportunity. So in the next verse, Krishna is going to explain that in a little more detail, right? But this is the confusion that Krishna leaves us with. Till now he's been telling, do it this way, do it that way, don't do this, don't follow that. But he's saying, what can self-control or what can coercion ever do? Because all of us operate according to our prakriti. We listen to the next verse and then we'll discuss about this a little more in detail. I think the discussion is not going to end in this week. It also continues to the next shloka, which we'll do next week. But we'll do verse number 34 for now and we'll see what Krishna is saying.
Indriyasyendriyasyarthe ragadveshau vyavasthitau tayor navashamagachet tauhyasya paripanthinau.
Attachment and aversion for the objects of the senses abide in the senses. Let none come under their sway, for they are the obstacles on the path. So here Krishna explains what fundamentally binds us. So we may have a hint as to where to start from. Where is that window of opportunity that we were talking about? Krishna says, Indriyasya indriyasya arthe ragadveshau vyavasthithau. Now there are two ways of translating this particular line. It depends on how you split the words and how you group the words. One is, to put it this way, Indriyasya arthe means objects of the senses. Raga dvesha vyavasthithau. Raga and dvesha, well, our favorite words, we've been speaking about it for quite some time now, likes and dislikes, or love and hatred, or attachment and repulsion, however you'd like to define it, because raga and dvesha goes from simple likes and dislikes to having a strong aversion or a strong attachment to something. So that entire gamut is covered by these two words, raga and dvesha. So he says, raga dvesha vyavasthitau. Raga and dvesha exists in indriyasya arthe, right? So when Krishna says, indriyasya indriyasya arthe raga dvesha vyavasthitau, it means raga and dvesha relating to the sense objects exists in each sense organ. So that's one of the ways many of the translators put it. Another way of explaining the meaning is the way Adi Shankara gives the explanation in his Bhashyam. He says, indriyasya indriyasya arthe, for each and every object of the sense. So indriyasya indriyasya is, it's a literal form where words are repeated to say, you know, each and every one. You know, it's like saying that indriyasya indriyasya means this sense and that sense also. It's a way of putting it that way. So he says, indriyasya indriyasya arthe, for each and every object of the sense, raga dvesha vyavasthitau. There is a like and dislike. Well, this is only for the semantic, but the meaning or the overall understanding that we have to get from this is pretty much the same. That I was not sure which is the right one, so I thought I'll anyway share with you both the ways of explaining it. But we will see that the meaning does not change much, or the idea of what Krishna is conveying does not necessarily change much. The eye is the sense organ. The word we use for that, for a sense organ, is indriya. And the forms or sights that this indriya sees is referred to as indriyasya arthi, or the objects of that particular sense organ. Similarly, for the indriya of the ears, the sounds become the artha. For the indriya of the tongue, taste becomes the artha. Right? So when you say indriyasya, indriyasya arthi, the indriyas are the sense organs. Indriya arthi are the sense objects which are perceived through the senses. Now, there is a specific set of likes and dislikes that define each one of us. I think we've spoken about this before also. You know, as a person, there are certain sense of taste that I have. And similarly, you too will have your certain sense of taste. For instance, when you're talking about the taste of the tongue, I might like spicy food. You might like food that is a little more bland. And when it comes to listening to music, I might probably like fast-paced rock or hard metal or whatever it is. As a person, you might like soft Carnatic classical music, right? So we have this huge list of likes and dislikes, as I said, ranging from simple likes and dislikes to aversions and attachments, what we refer to as raga and dvesha. We have a list. If you were to make a huge and comprehensive and a long winding list of what I like and dislike, the fact is most of us don't even know what we like and dislike unless the situation comes, right? But we think, at least let's say that if I'm able to completely find out whatever I like and dislike, if I have to make a list, that entire list of my likes and dislikes is nothing but a definition of my personality. Similarly, each one of us have different combinations of raga and dvesha, indriyasya indriyasya arthe, with reference to each of these indriyas or the sense organs, right? And that is what is referred to as my nature or my prakriti. Or if I were to more accurately put it, my prakriti, or the other word, as I said, is swabhava. My prakriti or my nature is expressed in the conscious level as likes and dislikes. Why am I saying in the conscious level? Probably if I have time, I'll come to that, or we will eventually come to that when we're talking about the next verse. But there is this prakriti or the nature that expresses itself in our day-to-day living, in our day-to-day conscious life, as likes and dislikes. And when my prakriti is similar to another person's prakriti, I will end up spending more time with that person. I will enjoy that person's company, right? And probably this is the Sanskrit version of birds of the same feather flock together, right? Because it is the prakriti, or this complex combination of raga and dvesha, which defines who I am. And if there is enough overlap between my raga and dvesha and your raga and dvesha, I would enjoy spending time with you, right? So Krishna says that is what we are. That is natural. And we tend to make choices based on this. So when I go out to a restaurant, this nature of mine makes me choose what I eat. When I make new friends, this nature kicks in and decides what kind of friends I pick. When I choose a life partner, again this nature comes into play. When I choose which city I want to live in, what kind of job I want to do, what kind of wardrobe with what kind of clothes I want to have in it, all of this is actually expressions of this prakriti expressing itself as raga and dvesha. Now, this nature is not just what I'm born with, right? A part of it is completely in the subtle subconscious level where I have no clue. That's why I said sometimes we don't even know what we like and dislike, because it comes from that part of the mind which is not accessible to us. And that's why we refer to it as the subconscious mind. Don't worry about what's a conscious mind, subconscious mind. I'm sure that all these discussions will come up as we go through the Bhagavad Gita. But for now, the mind, there is an inaccessible part of the mind where our nature actually lies, what we refer to as prakriti. And from there, in the conscious state, in the perceivable level, like I'm awake right now, I know what I like, I know what I don't like. But I don't know what has led me to like something and what has led me to dislike something, right? So some of these raga and dvesha come from my subconscious thinking, and that is what I'm born with. But a lot of my raga and dvesha comes because of my upbringing too, right? The kind of family I was born in, the kind of environment I lived in, the kind of school I went to, the kind of activities that I did as I was growing up, right? So to a certain extent, even my upbringing, the culture I was raised in, the taste of the people around me, all of this also influenced my prakriti. So that is why, you know, Swami would often say when he's speaking about marriages, yes, if I were to choose a life partner, I will look for a similar nature, right? Or a similar set of raga and dvesha. But Swami would say, you know, when two people get married, it is about two families coming together. And so there should be enough raga and dvesha combination of, you know, these individuals with those individuals. It's not about only one individual and the other. It's about two families coming together. So that becomes easier when the cultures are similar, is what Swami would say, because culture influences the raga and dvesha of an individual. So when you're talking about a conglomeration of individuals, what we refer to as a family, it is easier to overlap one family's nature with the other family's nature when they come from the same cultural background, right? That's one thing which Swami would say. Even though there is no concept of caste, there is no concept of religion, and Swami would say there's only one religion, religion of love, there's only one caste, caste of humanity. Swami would say, but still the cultures are different, so that has to be kept in mind when you are getting into a marriage with another person. That's a different topic altogether, but I'm just saying how all of this falls into place. So the bottom line is, whenever I have a choice before me, I always operate on the basis of my nature. This raga and dvesha dictates my choices. So what can we really do? Krishna is repeating what he said in the previous verse. He's not saying where we can operate the free will, right? He's not given us the clue still. The answer to that is probably in the next line and the shlokas that are going to follow. So Krishna says in the second line, Tauhi, these two certainly, asya paripanthinau, are the obstacles. These two means raga and dvesha. So Krishna is saying your likes and dislikes are the obstacles to you in your path. What is the path? The path leading to the ultimate goal. And here is the practical command which Krishna is giving. Tayoho na vasham agachet. Na vasham agachet. Do not come under the influence or do not become the slaves. Tayoho. Of these two. Yes, our actions are constantly dictated by our nature, which expresses as likes and dislikes, raga and dvesha, but try not to become a slave of your likes and dislikes. And there is the hint as to what we can do. Especially for us youngsters, especially for us who are living in this modern world, you know, this I think is a very, very important instruction. Because when we go through life, I think as a generation, we constantly want to exercise our likes and dislikes. We often speak about the freedom to choose what we want, do what we want, make our own decisions. I'm not saying that it is wrong, but we do not realize that we are more bound when we do that than we think we are free. Because as Krishna is saying, whatever choices you make, raga and dvesha, likes and dislikes, it is not you who is choosing it. There is this nature behind you which you have no clue about, which is dictating you to do it. And you are thinking that you are being free to choose what you want to do. You are leading the life the way you want it, you want to lead it. And I think this is again, as I said, is a continuation of what Krishna spoke about as prakriti and gunas in a couple of verses back, right? So you are thinking that you are being free in exercising your choice, but it is actually making you more bound, right? So it would certainly serve us better if in some way we can, once in a while at least, overrule our likes and dislikes. As Krishna is saying, try not to be completely under the influence of raga and dvesha. Na vasham agachet. He's saying, Tayoho na vasham magachet. Don't be slaves to your likes and dislikes. So that is the clue. Which means, yes, most of the time, whenever there's a choice in front of us, we will be operating our choice. We will be doing what we like and dislike. But don't completely be under the sway of likes and dislikes. Don't completely be a slave to them. Once in a while, stand up and say that, no, this is not what I have to do, even though I like to do it, or I have to do this, even though I don't like to do this. So when we are made to follow disciplines as youngsters, discipline as students, or when we follow our duty over what we would otherwise like to do, say that, no, this is my duty, I have to follow it. In all these things, we are putting or we are stepping ahead of our likes and dislikes, right? That is what technically we are doing. And how do we make this? How do we make this choice? Again, there's two words that I've spoken about. We will again be speaking about it a little more. Shreyas and Prayas, right? What is pleasant and what is right? What is pleasant? If I'm allowed to do what I like, if I'm allowed to run away from what I dislike, that is pleasant, right? That's what we refer to as pleasant. And we say, oh, today's weather is very pleasant, which means I like this weather. That's what it really means. Or you say, oh, what a horrible day it is today, which means I don't like the weather or I don't like whatever is happening during that day. And if I'm allowed to run away from that, I'll be happy. Or if I'm allowed to, you know, I come early in the morning at around 7:30 and it's a beautiful weather, or say, I love this weather, let me go on walking for about 1 hour, right? I would be happy to do that, but then my duty kicks in at around 8 o'clock and I have to come here and be here, right? So when we say that it's a pleasant day, or it's a beautiful day, or it's what we are actually meaning is, it is all happening according to my likes. So when we do things that we may not otherwise like, yes, I love to be out. It's pouring rain and I would love to go out and dance in the rain, but then I have this meeting to attend and this is more important, right? So prayers always means that which is pleasant, and invariably prayers is blindly following raga and dvesha. Shreyas is, this is what I like to do, but what am I supposed to do at this point in time? So if we were to constantly make this discrimination, right? So it is almost like, that is why I was making a reference to the subconscious and the conscious. I don't know if I'm going to make it clear, whether I'm going to come across as clear. If it doesn't, don't worry, because we'll be revisiting this concept a few times at least before we complete the third chapter. We are talking about prakriti or nature. And much of that prakriti is in the subtle mind or the subconscious mind. I have no access to it. Why do I like a certain person? Why do I not like a certain person? Why do I like a certain profession? Why do I don't like a certain form of music? All of these things, I don't know the answer to that. So all the likes and dislikes for which I don't have a particular reason to give, I think it would be fair enough to say that it comes from the subconscious nature. And then there is this nature which is a result of the process of nurturing that you've gone through, the schooling that you've gone through, the family that you've been born in, or whether you've been coming to Prashantinilam very often, you visit ashrams very often. So all of these natures also add to this subconscious mind, but in a very small way, right? So one of the things that Krishna is saying is, what you do now, what you are performing as actions right now, also is modifying this prakriti, right? And that's the most important point. I am acting now. Let's say certain actions that I perform are dictated by my nature. But when I am doing that action, it again reinforces that nature of mine. Let's say I'm a person who is, you know, who foul mouths everybody. In a meeting, I just lose my temper and I do not respect other people. I shout at them, right? Why am I doing that? Because it's my nature. For some reason, that prakriti is pre-programmed in my mind. And I do that, and the more times I express that nature in actions and words, I am reinforcing that nature in my mind, right? If I were to bring a small filter in between, right? Let's say I'm a person who likes to shout and yell at people. I come in contact with Swami, or I come in contact with a discourse or with a guru who tells me that you should always respect people because all of them are forms of God, right? So now this idea becomes Shreyas. This idea becomes the right thing to do. So now I start filtering out my actions. Yes, there is a prakriti or nature. Yes, I have likes and dislikes. But now I start filtering out my actions with this new knowledge that I've got. Raga and Dvesha remains, prakriti remains, but I start consciously saying that, no, I don't want to do this, I want to do this. And the more right actions we do, we are remodeling this prakriti of us. And that is the whole idea. When Krishna says, jnanavan api, even the knowledgeable act according to the nature, there itself is the hint. If you want to do actions like a sthita prajna, if you want to do actions like a jnani, the only way is if you can make your nature that of a jnani. If you can make your nature that of a sthita prajna, right? And that is why Krishna is saying that do actions without attachment, do actions with equanimity, do actions without desires. When we were talking about the sthita prajna, we mentioned this. When Arjuna asks what are the traits of the sthita prajna, what is the idea behind it? If I can just follow the actions of sthita prajna, maybe I will also get the prakriti of sthita prajna. Because the more we act according to that nature, we will eventually get that nature. But it's a slow process. It will take a long time. Consciously doing efforts. That's why the saying that Swami says is so very important for a spiritual aspirant. When Swami would say, watch your words, watch your actions, watch your thoughts, watch your character and watch your heart. Probably it's in the increasing order of difficulty, right? It's easier to watch our words. It's easier to watch our actions, but it becomes progressively more difficult to watch our thoughts, character and heart, right? Because we have lesser control of it. The character and the prakriti and the swabhava and all that is in the subconscious. We have very little access to that. And the only access we have is through our actions, through our words, and through controlling our raga and dvesha. It's like a diabetes patient, right? There is a plate of sweets in front of him. If you take that sweet and put it in his mouth, the senses will enjoy it. Right, as Krishna is saying, indriyasya indriyasya arthe, there is a certain raga and dvesha related to the senses. The senses will enjoy it. But this person says that, you know, if you put that sweet in my mouth, I will find it tasty and I will relish it, but it is not right for me. That becomes shreyas. That becomes that filter of shreyas and says, no, that is not right for me, so I will not take it. Right? So that small window of opportunity is there, and that is what Krishna has been asking us to literally exploit, and that is what every scripture has been telling, that you do have that opportunity to change who you are. You may be born as Ratnakara, but you can become a Valmiki. You might have been born as an Angulimala, but you have the opportunity to become a noble person if you choose to make changes now onwards. Right, and that is the greatest blessing, and this is not coming from any guru or any person like me who is simply reading books and sharing it out, but it is coming from the Lord Himself. These are the promises of the Lord. And when the Lord gives a promise, when the Lord says that you do this and you will get this, it is a promise that stands for eternity. It is not like it has a validity period. It's not that it has an expiry date. These are all truths which are valid for times immemorial, right? And that is why Swami would say, it could be the peak of Kali, but if you do the right thing, for you it is Satyuga. It might be the worst of times, but if you have devotion in your heart and if you're doing the right thing, it can for you become the best of times. So with that, dear listeners, let's conclude this week's episode. We'll continue with the shlokas remaining. And this is a very, very important point of the Bhagavad Gita. Till now, we saw what is Karma Yoga, but how can we start doing Karma Yoga, or how can we become Karma Yogis is what Krishna is speaking about here. In a way, Arjuna is going to ask a question which kind of has been answered already, but then Krishna is going to give a little more input into what he refers to as prakriti and what he refers to as actions which we do involuntarily. But all that in time. Thank you for joining me. Do join me again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the resumption of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet, and I thank you all for this opportunity of joining you week after week in this satsang. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Till I meet you all next week, take care. Sayonara.
Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.